From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last fall with an eclipse that was visible in some parts of the world. In Phoenix, a group of women was preparing for the event. Crystal Curley is a member of the Navajo Nation. In the days leading up to the eclipse, she led a presentation for her Indigenous Women's Work Group about the event. It was a chance for participants to connect or reconnect with Navajo cultural protocol, some from hundreds of years ago. During the meeting, a medicine man gave this advice to the Navajo women. During the eclipse, don't look at the sun, don't eat, drink, sleep, don't engage in physical activity. Instead, he advised participants to sit and reflect or pray. In Navajo culture, the eclipse is considered an intimate celestial moment. Curley described the group's meeting to the Associated Press, and the AP reported, quote, "In Navajo culture, an eclipse is about solemnity, not spectacle. It marks the end of a cycle and the power of when the moon and sun are in alignment. When the sun is blocked, it is undergoing a rebirth. It also is seen as the moon and sun embracing one another," end quote. The cultural significance of an eclipse varies among Indigenous peoples. It's not a monolith, of course. And now as we prepare for another eclipse, totality on Monday, many Indigenous groups around the country, including in our area, are using this event as an opportunity to not only share their traditions and to ensure younger generations learn sacred stories. Some Indigenous educators are hoping the eclipse will inspire teachers and students and scientists to think about how to merge Indigenous and Western ways of approaching STEM and humanities education. If you're in Rochester, or you plan to be in town this weekend or on Monday, of course, you can take part in an event where you can learn about Indigenous culture related to the eclipse. Our guests this hour are helping us preview the Sky Earth Eclipse Festival at the University of Rochester. They're going to guide us through exploring the significance of the eclipse for Indigenous people. And I'd like to welcome our guest this hour. Jim Rock is a Dakota. Jim is with us as a science educator and director of Indigenous programming for the Planetarium and Physics and Astronomy Department of Swenson College of Science and Engineering at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Jim, welcome. Thanks for making time for us. There, Jim. Oh, boy, we had Jim a second ago. We'll make sure we've got Jim here. Joel Helfrich is with me in studio. He is a public historian. Hello, Joel. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I know you know Jim pretty well. We're going to get Jim on here. This is someone that you go back with a bit.
Yeah, I met Jim first around 2001 when I was a graduate student at the University of Minnesota. I was writing a dissertation about a little-known boxer in the early 19th century, a black boxer. And I learned through activist friends of mine that the University of Minnesota, where I was teaching and also studying, had planned to join a telescope project on a sacred and ecologically unique mountain in Arizona called Mount Graham or Dzilnachasian in Apache. And the more I learned about what was happening, the more I got involved, the more I realized it was a bad idea, or at least felt it was a bad idea. And through that effort of trying to stop the university where I was studying from joining this the astrophysical development project on this sacred and ecologically unique place, I ran into and bumped into Jim Rock and got involved with him and his wife and a number of other local Indigenous activists who were doing great work. And we've stayed in touch over the last 23 years. And I jumped at the chance to be able to bring him to Rochester as well as, you know, four other Indigenous scientists and educators.
What have you learned from Jim over the years, Joel?
Humility. Just how much I don't know. Somebody like Jim has got this superior intellect, I feel like, and knows quite a bit. He's a jack of all trades. He's an amazing educator, a really wonderful human being. But, you know, you learn how to be humble in so many ways and how to be cognizant of, aware of, and conscious of the things that we don't know. Some of those are the things that I've learned from Jim, but he's also a really kind person, and that comes across in his teachings and also in his the way in which he treats others.
Can you give me a sense, Joel, for what you are hoping that the public can take from? Let's start with the Sky Earth Eclipse Festival. It's happening from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Sunday. We know by Sunday our region is going to be even more bursting at the seams than is typical. We've got a lot of visitors from out of town, and there's a lot going on. And this Sky Earth Eclipse Festival is happening at Rush Rhys Library at the University of Rochester. It is free. Tell me about it.
So last year, when we looked around at all the planning that was taking place in the area in advance of the eclipse, I felt as if, and a number of other local folks felt, that there was not enough emphasis on Indigenous peoples vis-a-vis the eclipse and Indigenous knowledge. And so the effort was put forth to say, hey, who can we invite to Rochester to help us better understand not only sky-earth events, but also the eclipse in particular? And so we latched on to five, again, scientists, Indigenous scientists and educators from Western Canada, from Toronto, from Minnesota, and we've invited them to speak at the University of Rochester over the on Sunday and on Monday. So the plan is for the festival is that each of the five speakers are going to have time between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. to speak. There'll be time for engagement and questions, and they're going to be making connections between STEM-related fields and, for example, the humanities, social sciences, and arts, what Jim Rock calls CLAY, and that stands for culture, language, arts, and humanities, and the H is pronounced like a Y, so it's the CLAY sound. And so they're going to be talking about those issues, and it's a free event. We have actually free lunch. So there's no reason not to show up. And even though there are a lot of other things that you could be doing on Sunday and a lot of other events locally, we hope that, you know, parents, children, you know, the community will come out and hear these folks speak.
And 10 to 4. And if people only have an hour or two, perhaps, to share, that's okay. They can be there at Rush Reese Library anywhere in that window. Is that right, Joel?
That's right. Yeah. You can come and get lunch and listen to a talk and then take off, whatever fits in your schedule.
Well, we're glad to have Jim Rock with us, a science educator, and as I said, the director of Indigenous Programming of the Planetarium and Physics and Astronomy Department of Swenson College of Science and Engineering at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Hi again, Jim. How are you?
Hello, my name is Jim Rock. I'm doing well. How are you, Evan and Joel?
It's great. Wonderful. Nice to hear. I'm sure it's nice for Joel to hear your voice as well here. Jim, in fact, Joel told us this really beautiful story of your first meeting over the years and what he has learned from you. Do you remember, what was it you say, 20, 22 years ago, Joel? Is that right?
At least, yep.
Do you remember, Jim?
Oh, wow. Yes, definitely. We were unfortunately kind of entangled, embroiled in some sky earth issues right here in the Twin Cities, University of Minnesota. This is our Dakota Makoche Chokayakin, our center of the universe. It's where the Mississippi and the Minnesota rivers join. It's kind of like the navel in our cosmology. Well, our University of Minnesota and the University of Arizona, we're collaborating on building a telescope on Tsiltinchasiang, the Apache Sacred Mountain. And Joel's dissertation research and his wonderful commitment to our Indigenous communities allowed my wife and I and many of us, we had been aware of this for a few years. And it makes it difficult when you're both a scientist and Indigenous because, as I said, which leg would you have me cut off? I would prefer to dance on both legs.
Hmm. Well, we're talking to Jim Rock. If you're just joining us, Jim will be part of the events this weekend that Joel Helfrich has helped organize here. And I want to spend some time on this concept that Joel just mentioned called, pronounced CLAH, C-L-A-H. So you often hear about STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. CLAH is C-L-A-H, culture, language, arts, and humanities. And Jim, you want to take us through how you view the importance of CLAH and how it kind of intercedes with the work here?
Oh, sure. I'll give it a try. I came up with the acronym just because it's the way we have always been raised, the way we live. It's what I guess academics we would say is interdisciplinary. Our science is also infused with music. Our mathematics is there in beadwork or quill work or you know, baskets and our dance. And so if you think of 4 plus 4 being 8, or the cardinal directions, north, south, east, west, or the intercardinal directions. You put those together and you have sort of the 8 legs of a spider weaving science, tech, engineering, and math, but also culture, language, arts, and humanities. The other thing I'm thinking of is you probably are aware that Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, that's how we say it. It's where the sky mirrors the water mirrors the sky. Mini is water. But we also have this pipe stone, is the word in English, but it's that sacred stone that is used, and we all would share this around Turtle Island, all indigenous nations. And when you join the stem of the pipe, maybe made of sumac wood or whatever, and then with the clay, it's a type of metamorphic rock or clay. It's reddish, beautiful color. And so when stem and clay are joined, it opens up communication to and from the entire universe and all our relatives. Mitakuya wasin, we say, we are all relatives.
Let me ask Jim and Joel an extension of this idea of clay and the eight legs of the spider and the interweaving of these different ideas. Joel and I have talked over the years about some of the stereotypes or the lack of proper education about indigenous culture. I mean, I can't even count now the amount of American public school children who I've met, who non-indigenous children who would say, well, you know, I thought, you know, the Indian people lived a long time ago, you know, as opposed to having any understanding or context of Native communities, indigenous cultures today. And I think part of the stereotyping that sometimes you hear is that, indigenous culture has many traditions, but they're not scientific necessarily, or they're not, that they're lacking in scientific or mathematical knowledge, et cetera. And Jim, I want to give you some space to kind of talk about that and why you think it's very, very important for people to understand. When we talk about clay, you talk about the eight legs of the spider. Included in that is, of course, science, but it is a perspective on science that brings in a lot of these different ideas that you're talking about.
Well, I really appreciate your interest and this opportunity today. And also, I really do hope people come to the events, the University of Rochester, and all the wonderful folks there have planned. Yes, I think definitely it's unfortunately from big media and Hollywood, we have been seen as somehow participating in mythology or folklore, or our stories are somehow less than scientific. The way I see this is we are just as much philosophers and scientists as any other cultures around the planet through millennia. And we believe in, and we do, as scientists do, a long-term observation, very long-term place-based observation. If you stay in one place long enough, you will notice patterns. Those patterns are mathematical. Observing for a long time is called phenology, and taking track, recording those patterns. And then once you develop a philosophy of phenology, you have the philosophy called phenomenology. And for those who want to look at the Western somewhat equivalents of this, you'll find, you know, names like Husserl and others. But we also have, for example, Dr. Gregory Cahete. He's an amazing colleague, good friend, mentor as well. He's from the Tewa, Santa Clara people. I'm sorry, I might have just my screen just went on screensaver here, so hopefully that's all right. But Greg Cahete is amazing, and he has a book called Native Science. It's been out about 20 years or so ago. He's got others to follow that, but I like to, you know, along with Greg, say that there, our way of learning is interdisciplinary. It's intergenerational, so all ages learn at the same time. It's holistic. In other words, the part reflects the whole and the whole the part. It's like a fractal, again, a new term that, you know, has mathematically just been put out in the last 40 years or so, but it's noticing that patterns in sunflower seeds or galaxies, maybe spiral or seashells, or and then you can measure how much of a spiral that is. You know, it's not always just golden ratio. Notice how I don't necessarily call it the Fibonacci ratio. It doesn't have to have an Italian name because it's all over the planet, and it's number patterns like 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89. And what you'll notice, those ratios is as you count the number of swirls clockwise or counterclockwise, for example, on the sunflower seeds or plants, you'll notice these patterns. So our people built structures based in that. But when I say our people, I should be careful here. My dad, my ate, he's Dakota, but we noticed patterns as we shared across Turtle Island. That's North America, but we can even extend that into Central and South America. So I like to call this concept of building starkitecture, because the sky is showing how patterns and circularity, but cycles, not just circles, but cycles, cycles of circles. And so the sky-earth connections show this starkitecture in how we all build a structure for where we live. Some of those structures have to deal with extreme heat or dryness or cold or, you know, glaciers, volcanoes. So there's going to be distinction. But anyway, I guess I'm saying that, you know, it's our way of learning is interdisciplinary, intergenerational. It's holistic. So we see these patterns and parts and in the whole. It's also very, here's a term that Western science doesn't use very much. It's spiritual. It allows for not just curiosity, but the great mystery. We say takushkanshkan or wakantanka, that which moves all that is moving. We leave room for, and again, our humility that what we don't understand, we don't try to know it all. And we're as humans in our cosmology, we're the last to come along or be made here. And in that sense, we have to learn. Whoops.
We still got you there, Jim. I think we still
okay.
Got you. Yeah, we got you, Jim.
Great. All right. I'll pause there because I'm getting some audio. Let me figure out what that is.
All right. So we'll let Jim figure out the audio on his end. Right. Jim is joining us, by the way, from University
okay,
of Minnesota Duluth
that.
And coming to Rochester. Joel, do you want to add to some of what Jim is talking about, kind of the intersection of these ideas?
Well, I was going to actually ask Jim to elaborate on this, especially regarding place-based knowledge and the importance of place in understanding indigenous knowledge. And I was going to ask him actually to help us think about the North Star, which is it a false star, Jim? Is that right?
Are you hearing us, Jim?
Yes, I have audio. Hope
okay.
You can hear me.
So the North Star is a false star.
My laptop keeps asking me how it might help me.
It's not helping to tell
no.
Tell Jim.
So the point is, yes, that the North Star, we say star is Wichangpi, Wichangpi. Wheat is the sun. Chang is like a tree or wood. So how is a star sort of like the sun and wood or a tree? Well, we have this cottonwood tree, and inside every little twig on every branch, the cottonwood tree branches kind of look like knuckles, little twigs. If you snap them open when they're kind of dry, have them falling, you'll find a five-pointed star embedded in there, almost like when you slice open an apple, a sort of a five-pointed star shape, something that my Dakota dad said, you know, about that. Well, so the sun is one of those stars, and the star is a sun, and it's embedded in the tree. That tree becomes the Milky Way for us. That cottonwood tree is both a Milky Way and also the river, the largest river, where it's the, you know, Hahawakpa or the Mississippi in English there, or Ojibwe version of English. And so, yes, the North Star now is Polaris. It's the last star in the Little Dipper, the Little Bear. But it turns out that 5,000 years ago, that star was the wingtip of the Thunderbird for my people here. And that is a star between the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper. You know how to find the North Star using the outer two stars of the Big Dipper. Well, if you use the inner two stars of the Big Dipper, kind of where the handle joins, those two will point up to a star that was the center 5,000 or so years ago. That's also the time when the Egyptians were building the pyramids, their pyramids, and all the stars dance around that one center star. So we also refer to that as the star that doesn't move, or the one star at the center. You mentioned in the Diné tradition as well that, you know, you have the male revolving one and the female revolving one, and they circle and revolve or dance around the central fire. So over many long millennia, in fact, 13 millennia is only half which would be 26,000 years,
right.
A little less than that, is a full circle. So you could say that Polaris now is that center, and it was the center 26,000 years ago. Now, half a wobble ago, or half of that cycle, it was closer to Vega, the one known as Vega. But that's when the glaciers here were 13,000, were maybe 1 to 2 miles high, 1 to 2 miles thick here. So we didn't, you know, stay here. We were here before those glaciers, but we went south, perhaps, and I think so, and had these eclipse conferences over long times.
So talking to Jim Rock. Jim is Dakota. He is a science educator and director of the Indigenous Programming for the Planetarium and Physics and Astronomy Department of Swenson College of Science and Engineering at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And Jim is a longtime friend of my guest in studio, Joel Helfrich, who's a public historian. And Joel has helped organize the Sky Earth Eclipse Festival on Sunday from 10 to 4 at the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. So maybe I should have started with this, but let me just ask both of you where you plan to be on Monday. And, you know, I had a conversation this morning with astrophysicist Adam Frank, who is going to be doing the totality thing for the first time. And he said he is convinced it will really be this kind of grounding spiritual experience. I mean, you don't know until you're in the middle of it, of course. It's hard to ask somebody, how do you think you're going to feel for 3 minutes and 38 seconds? But I wonder how much you've thought about it, Joel. I'll start with you and where you plan to be and what you think it might mean to you.
So my partner and I are trying to figure that out, actually, still. And, you know, we're not sure if it's really going to be 500,000 people here and the traffic is going to be crazy or nuts or unbelievably difficult or whatever. But I don't know yet. The folks who are going to be at the event on Monday have the opportunity to stay on at the University of Rochester and view the eclipse. You know, hopefully we can see it. But I don't know. I don't have an answer. Jim's going to be, I assume, at the University of Rochester after the event, and he'll see the event there. But, you know, In terms of how I'm going to feel, I'm not sure. I'm actually not sure. You had a guest on from City News, City Magazine, you know, a month or so ago, and what's his name, who had written an article about
Gino, about how cynical
Gino,
he is about.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm kind of in that boat a little bit, I think. So it's probably not best if I answer this question.
I'm surprised. Why do you find yourself leaning in the cynical direction, Joel Helfrich?
I mean, I just think that I kind of agree with Gino that we put so much effort, time, money, energy into this. It may be a once in a lifetime event, but I'm not sure. I'm not convinced yet. You know, I guess we'll see after Monday that it's going to be that life changing for me. I don't see it. There's so many other things that I think we need to worry about in the world. And for me, this isn't the be all and end all.
Okay. Jim Rock, how do you think about it?
Wow. Well, I'm grateful to have lived long enough to have yet another eclipse. And even though the last one was an annular eclipse about 6 months ago, 177 days apart, I was up in Duluth. And for the one in 2017, 7 years ago, That was also called the Great American Eclipse. It went from Oregon over to the Carolinas, and a lot of people were driving to places like, you know, Carbondale, Illinois, South Illinois, and other places. But we had clouds, and I just want y'all to know that up at the Duluth Harbor there, our university team was on hand. We didn't have people come up the hill to the university. We went down to the people, and we also brought an inflatable planetarium, a geodome, and if weather conditions worked out and it was cloudy, we had hands-on activities, and we'll do the same. You know, for Sunday and Monday, we have a teacher institute on Monday, and I'll be bringing those kinds of things. But here's the hope. The clouds parted just enough, or they thinned enough, that we still needed our eclipse glasses, and you could see through the cloud that beautiful little piece that was remaining. We did not have a totality in Duluth 7 years ago. Now, I'd like you to picture the path, the lunar path, about 100, 115 miles wide, moving across North America from Oregon through the Midwest over to the southeast coast 7 years ago. Then you had the one last October on the 14th coming up, are also coming from the west coast and kind of curving down through the Yucatan Peninsula, you know, curving through the Gulf Coast, across the Gulf of Mexico into the Yucatan Peninsula and on down to South America. Now, this one will be coming not from the northwest, but from the southwest Mexico area, and the path will be coming up and crossing through San Antonio, which I might point out was where the 6 month ago path went, kind of right through the western edge of San Antonio. And so these two paths within 6 months, 177 days, they will be crossing at San Antonio, but also it will be crossing at Carbondale. And that Carbondale, Makanda. So anyway, I hope you heard that.
Yeah, absolutely. For you, do you think of this event as something special to individually experience? Do you have a different sense of it, Jim?
Oh, yes. In terms of, you know, how I feel, I really have always felt a strong lunar feminine connection. I don't know if that's genetics, culture, whatever it is, but we have a very special sacred site that I was born very near. And I've often tried to watch eclipses from there. So the sun being generally kind of, you know, that male solar, but the moon is able to block the sun. And in that sense, many of our indigenous cultures really see the inherent creative power of the woman. She is the co-creator of life. Our umbilical cords are connected to her, as we are all connected to Maka'ina, Earth Mother. And therefore, recognizing that inner calming, you know, say the umbilical, the heart, getting calm and recognizing it is a time of transition, a time of hope, let's say, but also uncertainty. I've often felt these opportunities call us to take a closer look at again, the violence, the motivations for which we live. Unfortunately, a lot of profit and money, capitalism there. So we need to take a look at why our planet is with climate chaos right now. It's an opportunity, I hope, for people to pause and then actually stop some of the negative things, do no harm, and then hopefully get active in reversing the harm done. That's what I always try to stay open. And I try to listen to my relatives. And in that sense, not just the two-legged relatives, but the crickets, the birds. When it gets really dark, if you're in a totality place, you know, there's this stillness, it seems, where there's an unusual, things are kind of out of order, and yet they're really not. This is an ancient order that's always been here. So the relatives were here long before us, the plants and the four-leggeds, the swimming, the winged. So they have a sense of showing us how to behave and what to do.
Well, when we come back from our only break of the hour, I want to make sure that our listeners understand there's a number of things happening. We've been talking about the Sky Earth Eclipse Festival, which is from Sunday at 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. It's free. If you've got even a short window in that day, there's a great chance to be there and to hear from educators, people who are going to offer storytelling, demonstrations, lectures, people like Jim Rock. And you don't have to be there for the whole time. They would love to see you there. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, and we're going to make sure that you also understand an opportunity for educators on Monday, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's called Through Indigenous Eyes, a Sky Earth Eclipse Teacher Institute. And that's happening through the Warner School at the University of Rochester. Let's take this break. We'll come back with our guests and have a lot more to share on that. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, a Connections unlike any before. It's true. We are going to be talking to people across the region as the totality experience nears. Monday, of course, is Eclipse Day. Our region is going to be flooded with people, and we hope the sky is clear. We're going to be with you from noon to 2, as always, and then a special live broadcast starting at 3 p.m. That's Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just a note about Monday. I don't know what that's going to be like. You know, we've had conversations about broadcasting an event that has a lot of different components. And, you know, I'm thinking about Kiki and the conversation we had. It's not, this is not just an event for sighted people, but it's a, you know, it's obviously got a very strong visual component. And can you broadcast it? Well, I'm not going to be doing a play-by-play of 3 minutes and 38 seconds. I'm going to let everybody breathe. But we do just want to be here and be in community with you. There's nothing like it. We don't really know what it will be like. I can't predict that. But if you want to be in community with us, we're going to try to respectfully and carefully, but also, I hope, enjoyably be with you during that time. And being together, I think, will be a nice thing. So I'll be on the roof. I'm going to be up on the roof of WXXI on Monday. And the latest forecast for just for the last hour show a little bit more of a trend toward cloud cover. The good news is there could be some breaks in the clouds. And also, a lot of the clouds we're going to have on Sunday are those high variety, like the thin ones. And, you know, Jim talked a little bit about that from 2017. There were communities that were worried about cloud cover, and it's like, you're not going to be able to see anything. Well, the high thin variety, sometimes you can see the sun, and you even need the eclipse glasses, as Jim said, for the 2017 event. So be optimistic if you're making plans for Monday, and we will be with you. Now, something that's happening starting that morning from 8 to 2 p.m., the Sky Earth Eclipse Teacher Institute, Joel Helfrich, it's through the Warner School. And for all the educators listening right now, and teachers, a lot of teachers are on break, there's a lot of teachers listening right now. Where do you want them to be on Monday?
So there's still an opportunity to register. We still have a number of spaces that are open for teachers, and they can get PD credit for the effort. It's at LaChase Hall, which is the Warner School of Education's main building, and it will be from, as Evan said, from 8 until 2. All the speakers that we're bringing from across Canada and Minnesota will be on hand, and there'll be a series of workshops from that. From the start to the finish, and we'll have free vegan cake, courtesy Belgian chocolate mousse cake, courtesy of Wegmans. And so,
your engineer through the glass is giving you a thumbs up. A lot of vegan love for that product, I guess.
So it's delicious. It's high time that Wegmans finally rolled it out. In any case, there'll be lots of cake on hand and lots of amazing speakers, and tons of knowledge will be shared. So. We're really hoping that those folks who are listening today and their friends and their friends of friends and their teacher friends will all register for the conference. I know that people have a lot they could choose from. There's a lot going on. And, you know, it would be hard to get from, I think, U of R to somewhere else for the eclipse, but you can stay on hand and on the campus. There'll be free glasses, and you can certainly watch the eclipse from there.
So that's 8 to 2. And how do people register? What's the best way they can do that?
Well, I think that Connections is probably going to put a link up after
the
show.
We are in our show notes. You knew we would do that.
So there are flyers up actually in Wegmans. Every Wegmans location has a flyer up about the Teacher Institute and the festival. So they're two separate flyers. And on that, there's a QR code and also the web link. So that's one way to do it. Otherwise, take a look at Connections later on today, and the link will be up. You just go online, register, tell us you're coming, and that's the way to make it work.
All right, so that's the event on Monday, 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. That's Through Indigenous Eyes, a Sky Earth Eclipse Teacher Institute. The festival that Joel and Jim and I have been talking about is on Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., the Sky Earth Eclipse Festival, and that's a great chance to pop in at any point during 10 to 4 for that free event. Opportunity to hear from speakers from really across this continent with Indigenous knowledge and traditions and a lot to share with you there. Let me get a little bit of feedback, and then we're going to talk more about the educational aspect of this. Michael says, I heard this amazing story on the news the other night. It was about the great peacemaker who was the prophet who brought peace to the five tribes and led to the formation of the Confederation that put an end to the endless wars between the five tribes. I'm part Seneca, and I knew this story, but what I didn't know until the other night was that there was a solar eclipse that helped convince the members of the five tribes to form the Confederation. Have any of your guests heard about that part of the story regarding the eclipse? Joel, I don't know that story. Do you want to weigh in on that?
What you're saying is true. The eclipse supposedly played a big role in that, in the peacemakers' efforts. The city newspaper actually had a full-page story that laid this out in the March issue, which is available online if you want to find out more about it. That's a story that has been told over and again.
Okay. Jim, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that particular email.
Oh, sure. I think through history all over the planet, eclipses have really been unfortunately used by humans to kind of project their own interpretations as to whether it's a good time for war or a bad time for this or that, and prognostication, for example. But I'm also going to be sharing about this eclipse from June 16, 1806, when Tecumseh and Tenskwatawa, the Shawnee prophet brothers, told William Henry Harrison, you don't seem to believe us that we really do want to follow the one creator that makes us all as brothers and sisters. And William Henry Harrison said, well, give me a sign, how do I know you really have the ear of that powerful one? So he gave him the exact date. And sure enough, something like, I think it was 50 to 70 days later, there was the eclipse. And that only enraged further William Henry Harrison, who would go on to become one of the presidents. But he then, of course, burned Prophetstown. And but how did, in 1806, these brothers predict an eclipse when, in fact, something called the Bessel numbers weren't known until 1824, 18 years later, over in Europe? Those are eight numbers used to describe the parameters of the eclipse path. And I will be showing on Monday a way that, you've probably been aware, as I have, that the folks in Central and South America, as we kind of use the term Inca and Maya, but there were many Incan groups and Maya groups as well. I wondered if, up here in the north, how we did this. And here it turns out, when I mentioned that special place where I was born, there were burial mounds there and some other mounds, not just for burial. And then about 14 miles away over on another river, there were effigy mounds. They're shaped like animals. One of those is a snake shape. And that snake was almost 2 football fields long. It had the head about 6 feet high. And again, about 2 football fields further away were 3 rattlesnake tail shaker mounds, 3 circular mounds, but of 2 different sizes. The end mound was about 20 feet diameter, and the 2 in front of the end mound were 18 feet. The entire structure was 534 feet. Well, then I realized what my dad and his grandmothers had shared with him was we measured by fingers, hands, and also a unit called the wichishpa. Wichishpa is a cubit from the inner elbow to the tip of the middle finger. That turns out to be like an umbilical cord. When I converted these measurements that had been left for us by a non-indigenous person who documented the mound sizes back in 1883, it turned out to be 364 of these wichishpas. And that's not a coincidence, because that's how many days we see in a year. Now, you may think, okay, 364, well, that's off by a day and a quarter or train. No, if you measure 13 months in a year, as we did, because the turtle shell has 13 pieces, 13 moons in a year, where each moon is 28 days, 13 times 28 is 364. We knew that the year was even more than 365. But if you want to understand when the syzygy, this is a Greek word for you, but when sun and moon and earth align, syzygy, we have our own words for this. But then to get the best number for what would be a solar calendar and a lunar calendar to kind of come together in a lunar-solar prediction pattern, I would say it this way. The turtle and the rattlesnake taught me how to predict eclipses. And very specifically, one's up here. It was 2 days before an eclipse event. In particular, when I did the math, it was 6,795 days instead of 6,797 days. That's a two-day warning, and I think that's the intended rattlesnake tail, you know, giving you the warning. You could get an eclipse here. Now, the when is different than the where. So you also have to understand these patterns, which come in 18-year or 19-year cycles, or a number in between. And there's even other numbers. So it turns out where I was born at our sacred mounds, there was a cave underneath what should have been 19 mounds. Well, those 19 mounds in the 1880s were all bulldozed, zero left of the 19. But in the cave underneath that, on the River Bluff by the Mississippi, there were drawings in the cave ceiling, including cave petroglyphs and buffalo, turtle, lizard, and so forth. Those are our star relatives, our star animals. We are buffalo people. We come from a star in that buffalo, as well as the connection to that cave. And we don't have time today to go into all of that cosmology. But up the hill, about 7/10 of a mile, there should have been 18 more mounds. So picture this, 19 mounds, and up the hill, the River Bluff, another 18. Why these two sets of mounds, 19 and 18? Well, those are the years for the eclipse patterns, an eclipse window. And it also gives you an angle. And that alignment points you 14 miles over to yet another river valley where that large snake is. So all of this took me mostly the last 6 to 10 years to kind of really let it soak in. But I started wondering about the real beauty and meaning of these places that were unfortunately totally changed by colonization. When I was probably single digits, my older cousins say I was asking questions about that. And so it's an honor. It's humble honor to get to share what each of us have learned. I know we have Tom Deere from Haudenosaunee Nations there. We have Wilfred Buck from the Cree Nations. We also have one of my Dakota, Sisitoan, Wahpetoan Dakota relatives from up at Whitecap Dakota First Nation. That's Chris Standing. We also have Gagige Anakwadekwe. And she's Ojibwe from Bad River, Ojibwe in northern Wisconsin. We'll have different perspectives, recognizing that there are many hundreds of us Turtle Islanders, all with our own place-based ancient understandings and the encoding of these patterns. There are, you know, for example, snake dances and so forth. Although, you know, this is the time of year when after spring equinox, once we start getting the rain, we don't discuss this. So, we're kind of out of the window of snow on the ground, and yet you guys just had some. So thank you for that. Nina Wopita.
Joel, I'm beginning to get an understanding of why you wanted Jim here this coming weekend. You're smiling. None of this is no surprise. Wisdom of an educator like this to you, huh?
Not at all. And, you know, it's amazing every time I hear Jim talk or talk with him, the stuff that I learn, the stuff, the connections that he makes, it's just, I always leave in awe, a little bit better educated, and then also humbled by what I don't know. And so it's important that he's here, and all the other folks that he just mentioned who are going to be here also have a tremendous amount of knowledge that they're going to bring to Rochester, and that we can all kind of learn from and take back to either our own communities, our own families, or our classrooms.
Well, and these events, to state the obvious, are open and encouraged to the general public. The Sky Earth Eclipse Festival from 10 to 4 on Sunday at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester, free, open to the public. Through Indigenous Eyes, a Sky Earth Eclipse Teacher Institute for all educators, Monday from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. Register in advance if you can, and we'll have a link on our connections page in the show notes later today. That's happening through the Warner School, really aimed at science and social studies teachers, but if you're an educator, I know they would love to have you there on Monday for that, and that's a great place to see the eclipse once the Institute ends. That campus is going to be a lovely place to see the eclipse. I have no doubt about that. Before I lose the hour, I know Jim has been a chemistry teacher, physics, astronomy, has taught for more than three decades at everywhere from reservation to urban and suburban high schools, colleges, universities. Jim, are you consistently in your career, have you found that the school system is lacking in certain ways with Indigenous culture? Has that improved and changed? Have you seen any evolution with that?
Oh, wow. Wonderful question, Evan. I really appreciate that. And I'll give you the 2-minute answer. Yes and no. Unfortunately, in your region, it may be more yes than no, more no than yes. And I'm proud of my scars now, but I can tell you that for a long time, because when it's who you are, it's how you live and breathe and speak and see. And, you know, right away in kindergarten, first, second, third, fourth grade, I had other nation, Ojibwe, Ho-Chunk, friends, Mexican, African-American, you know. So we learned a bit of each other's languages, and we'd go to each other's grandma's house or play baseball, and we shared culture with each other. So, you know, I'm very grateful that the east side of St. Paul was, you know, all about diversity and equity and inclusion. We didn't call it DEI back then. It's just who we were. However, not all of our teachers were open. And my wife had a, you know, terrible examples where she was raised, where they didn't even have two or three books on Indigenous perspectives. But I'm trying to say that as an educator, when I tried to incorporate my culture, other cultures into teaching, I was actually written up for that. They would put letters in a file that said, stop making cultural connections to science, quote unquote, or stop doing Indigenous science or Indian science. And another question, quote unquote, why does everything have to mean something? These are administrators who would ask these, you know, and you just try to take it, and those become the scars that, you know, at some point, that's why I admire Tecumseh and some of my wife people, she's Odawa, Ojibwe, you know, Pontiac and others who've continually resisted. I mean, when I mentioned before how Indigenous perspective to pedagogy and learning has been about being interdisciplinary, intergenerational, holistic, and spiritual, open to mystery, but it's also decolonizing and it's re-indigenizing in this sky earth kind of way. And that leaves us open to this deep philosophy, which has ethics. It's curiosity is not enough. It's about the ethics, our values that say, what should and shouldn't we be doing here for the long haul, for the 7+ generations ahead of us? And I think that's what the Peacemaker was also trying to say is, you know, the 50 or so of us that come together, and 50 was just the start, many more beyond. So I'd just like to also say that I gave a title to my my Sunday talk called I See Relationships, I see relationships in space time, and I see relationships in space time where the SEE is an acronym I see for sky earth eclipse relationships. I see sky earth eclipse relationships in space time where the time is Turtle Island, Mother Earth. So I see sky earth eclipse ships in space island, Mother Earth, space time.
Jim, I've so much enjoyed this. And I just want to close by saying, you know, when Jim says he was reprimanded for the way he was teaching, why does everything have to mean something? We are increasingly in a nihilistic culture where people think there's no meaning anywhere. And to find meaning and to really appreciate that, I think is so important. I also want to say, Joel, someone who I've known for years, has one of the most gentle and kind hearts. And my guess is Joel is going into Monday a little less jazzed because Joel is involved in the kind of work in our community that is very meaningful. And he sees a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. And it's hard to carry that with you. And what I just hope for you, Joel, is that you do find meaning Monday when this happens and that you do find a sense of something, some kind of peace and calming, because I know that you carry a lot with you. I'm grateful for the work that you do, and thank you for being here, Joel Helfrich.
Thanks, Evan.
And I want to thank Jim Rock, who is joining us from the University of Minnesota Duluth, who's going to be here for the Sky Earth Eclipse Festival Sunday from 10 to 4, and for the Teacher Institute Monday from 8 to 2 through the Warner School. Jim, an honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you both so much for allowing this to be publicized. Come and see us.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can see them on Sunday or Monday, and we'll have all the information in our show notes on the Connections page. From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. And Monday is, you know, it's going to be a day. We're going to be here, and let's see. Let's see how it goes. We will be with you all day Monday. Until then, have a great weekend.